about the Wilton House. The Wilton House was purchased, and it was in very great disarray, in 1986 by Ozzy, who came up here and saw the house and noticed that it was falling apart. It was this whole side of the meeting house was 4.5 feet lower than this side. There were floors collapsing. There was water coming in every room but one room. Only room 12 was a dry room. And there were 29 cats living in the house at that time. So you can imagine what it was like. But he took a look at it, seeing it from the post office, and said, "That looks familiar. I think I've seen that place," and pass it on. And he was up here looking for the cemetery. It took him 3 days. He didn't want to ask anybody where it might be. You know? You probably understand that, right? And he just happened to have, from an inheritance, enough money to purchase it. And he thought, this shouldn't fall down. This really needs to be a memorial. This really needs to be there for people in the program, for people to come and celebrate their new lives. And where, I remember him telling me he wouldn't ordinarily have made a decision just like that. But the postmistress at the time said, "Oh, there's the owner's son going by. Why don't you go talk with him?" So he did and found out the house was for sale that day. First day that they put it on the market. So he went out and talked to her, and before you know it, the same day, sitting in a lawyer's office, thinking, what am I doing? But knowing that it, you know, like you know when it's the right thing to do, when you just keep on. And the next thing you know, he was the owner. Well, he was the owner, but he didn't have any more money to fix it. So, and he thought, what am I going to do? So he put it in a nonprofit foundation and said it shouldn't really be owned by anyone. It should have a board of directors, and got a mortgage, and decided to find local people that he had to pay, some of them, of course, because they needed to be certified, and volunteers to fix it up. And that's what he did, and it took years. It seemed to us it took years. People who came, you know, year after year would say, oh, wow, you got so much done. But it took years to do it, a room at a time. And I can remember when every room upstairs was done except room 12. And that room still had peeling wallpaper, painted, but peeling wallpaper, and looked like the other rooms did before they were done. And I remember having a couple come in, and I said, well, there's one room left. And I didn't want to tell them what it was, but, you know, and they said, well, we'll take it. So I brought them upstairs, a young couple, and the wife walked into the room first, and she screamed. And I thought, that's it. You know, they're not going to stay. And she runs out into the hall, and she said, honey, it's just like our first apartment. And that's the way things go here. People were happy to stay even when the rooms were clean and painted, but not completely done. And today, of course, the maintenance is, like, you know, incredible on a house this size. The heating and the lighting and everything else is incredible. But you know what? Day at a time, things get done. And it was decided a long time ago by the first board that we would not have a gift shop, that we would depend on God each day to see us through. And we have incredible friends of the house who come up, and incredible friends, you know, like you and the Atlantic Group, who help support us and send in donations when we have our newsletter, bring in-kind gifts. Like, people came this weekend from here with, you know, paper towels and coffee, and they call and say, what do you need? And it's just exactly the things that we need that they bring at just exactly the right time. And I was a believer before I came here, but I'll tell you, I've seen things happen here that made me even more of a believer. Just incredible things that showed up at just the right time. So Bill was born here in the room behind the bar, out in the other room. If you don't know exactly where that is, please ask somebody to show you. There's a real grandiose light right in the corner where he was born. He would have loved that grandiose light, little fringes, you know, and everything. The light is left on 24 hours a day. All the time. Occasionally somebody forgets and turns it off and everyone has a fit. But it's left on in his memory. And it was meant to be a memorial, you know, not a shrine, but a living memorial here to him. He lived in the house only a couple of years, and then he moved to another place in town with his family. And then he moved to Rutland. While they were up there, his parents decided to divorce. And so the children, Bill and his sister Dorothy, were sent back to East Dorset, and they moved into the house across the Churchyard, which is the Griffith Library. Please be sure you see that before you go. It's really neat. There are pictures, old pictures there. There are lots of books. They're locked, but if there's anything you want to see, let me know. And that's where Bill lived until he went in the service. Now, he traveled back and forth. Train service was abundant here then, and he traveled back and forth and boarded down at Burburton Seminary, where he went to school. So he was there during the week, came back on the weekends. But it was here where he, you know, missed his mother and father so much, living there. His father went off to Canada and remarried. His mother went off and to Boston and became a doctor. I mean, unheard of back then, right, for a woman to divorce and become a doctor. It was incredible. And he was fortunate that his grandfather Griffith was a very kind, loving person, and Bill had incredibly fond memories of him. In the book, by 40 years, I think it is, by about Bill Wilson, he talks about his grandfather and all the things that happened at the Griffith house and how much his grandfather had to do with helping him to grow up. Back to the Wilson house. We have a volunteer program. Many of the people who come here are volunteers. They come for a week or two. It's getting harder and harder for people to come for a week or two now. So sometimes people come for a seminar weekend or something if they've been here before. We have a very structured program, so once you learn it, you know it forever. We can tell you in 3 minutes the next time you come what changed. And that helps tremendously. We also have a small group of paid people who work here. Because in the beginning, we could do it all with volunteers. Today, we can't. And we are starting a core staff trust fund. And it will be in the newsletter probably the next time around. We're trying right now to get some money so that we can say we've raised some. So that we can pay these paid workers well and give them benefits. Because you can't run a place like this on volunteers coming in every 2 weeks. You just can't do it. And we need to do that. And I hope that will be my legacy here. I hope to get that going and have it be my legacy before I leave. God only knows when that will be. I'm going to ask if there are any questions that you have to ask about the house. No. Did I talk about everything that you want? I want to talk a little bit about Dean. I want to tell you about Dean. Many of you probably knew Dean, right? How many knew Dean? Yeah. Dean was here for 15 years, and for 12 of those years, he had melanoma. He kind of kept it quiet. He got through it. He had a great attitude. He had surgery after surgery, different years, but he got through it, and he expected to get through the last bout that he had, but it had gone into his body, into some organs in his body, and it was very difficult for him. He was scheduled to start a clinical trial at Dartmouth-Hitchcock in New Hampshire. And by the time that his insurance approved it and he got ready to go and do it, it was just too late for him to have the chemotherapy. His body couldn't take it. And on April 8th of this year, he passed away right in the small meeting room. We set up a little room in there with a hospital bed. That's where he wanted to be. He didn't want to go back to Long Island because he knew his mom had her hands full. His father's also sick. And he wanted to be here. This had been his home for 15 years. And hospice came in, and another volunteer and I did the 24/7 with him. And one of our staff members brought in a 52-inch TV, set it up. He was so happy, a 52-inch TV. I could hear him at night. I'd be reading in there, and he'd be watching David Letterman laughing. And, I mean, right up till the last 2 days, he was still hopeful. He was still working on his appointments, and he was still telling me everything to do. Like he always did, you know. He was reminding me of everything. I mean, he planned even 2009 for me. You know, he's had everything planned. It was probably the most incredible death I've ever seen. He called people into the room, people who might have had a problem with him or whatever, and talked with them. He finally, the last couple of days before he died, he realized that his hope needed to be somewhere else, that he wasn't going to make it. And he asked me if I could find someone. And I called a friend and found a priest who was of his denomination. And the priest came in and talked with him. And it was an incredible transition for Dean. He went from being hopeful of living to being hopeful of where he was going. And that was just so wonderful. And that weekend, his college buddies came up. His sponsor came up. And they sat in the room and laughed and talked and laughed and reminisced. And for the first hour, they let me go in. They said I could be one of the guys. And then when they pulled out the little notebook with all the college stunts they pulled, they made me leave the room. And I could hear them laughing in there. But Dean gave so much to the house over the years. I mean, we used to say he could tell you off and you'd say thank you. He just had a knack of being able to do it. And he was an incredible buffer for Ozzy and I. He kind of let us have some privacy. And he stood like in front of us and took care of things. And I mean, just as a friend, I miss him so much. We all did. It was very, very difficult. It was like going through Ozzy's death all over again, you know, just a few years later. It was just difficult for all of us because here we're like a family. And we just needed, you know, somewhere to turn to get through it. It was hard. It was really hard. It remains hard. So please keep his family in your prayers. His father's not doing well at all. Has cancer that has now spread to his liver. So his mom's got a double whammy going on. I mean, she's just beside herself. I want to thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for listening to me ramble on. I kind of went back and forth. If you have any questions about things in the house or in the library or anywhere, please see me over the weekend and ask me. I'll be glad to stop and talk with you. And now I want to turn things over to Ron and get on with the day.
Thank you, Bonnie. That was dynamite. And Dean was a very good friend to the Atlantic Group. He was very accommodating every year that we came up here. And truth be told, he actually did tell me off quite a few times, and I always did say thank you to him when he did it. So, are we ready to start?
All right.
Let's start. So we're going to start the big book study with a general talk of the traditions, the 12 traditions, our second legacy. All right? And to present the traditions this morning, there is a gentleman whose name is Chaz. And Chaz was an area chair for a GSO from the state of New Jersey. And there was a young lady by the name of Becky, and she was an area chair from the state of Vermont. And 5 years ago, they were at one of these area chair conventions or something that they have, and they met. And they fell in love. And they got married. And because they're both sober, Chaz had to move from Jersey to Vermont. And they were about 40 miles away from the Wilson House. And they drove up here this morning to do the 12 traditions for us. And for me, the kicker is this past Wednesday, they celebrated their third wedding anniversary. So please help us welcome Chaz and Becky.
Frothy emotional appeal.
At least we're out of the terrible twos now.
How come you're higher?
So they can see me better, honey. My name's Becky, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Becky.
I'm Chaz. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chaz. Our home group is the Fairhaven Group in Fairhaven, Vermont, and we have three meetings a week. On Monday, we do the steps out of the 12 and 12. We also do a tradition once a month. On Thursday, we do the steps out of the big book, and on Friday is our open discussion meeting. And as one of our members like to say, that's when we openly discuss those of you who are at the other meetings and didn't come back on Friday night. My sobriety date is January 15th, 1990, and I'm one of those really lucky people. I haven't had to drink since I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard a little bit about AA before I came here, and I got the idea that you shouldn't drink after you came to AA, so I waited till I was really ready. I tell you, you know, y'all know about our drinking, but I always like to qualify about with the first time I felt the effects of alcohol. I was in third grade, and it was at Christmas. I was a really shy little girl. And my family had a tradition of having, you know, a brunch in the morning and a bottle of champagne, just the four of us, before we went to the relatives, so that we all had a good meal and my parents had a little celebration. And they give us sips of the champagne. Now, my grandfather was a really bad drinker, and my mother suffered abuse at his hands. And she wanted to teach us to drink like ladies and gentlemen. Well, it didn't work. But that day, I felt the effects of the alcohol, and I went from being this, you know, always withdrawn, and I was funny and laughed, and I also had my first hangover that day. I didn't know that was what it was, but as we go over the river and through the woods to my grandparents' house, I felt like crap, and that really set the stage for my drinking. On January 15th, I was driving to my job down here in Manchester, Vermont, at a restaurant. I live, you know, 40 miles from here. Seemed like a good place to work. I was the designated driver that night, and we went out after work. And for years, I said I only had one or two, but on the way home, we got pulled over by the local cops in Manchester. And, you know, they did the whole sobriety test. I, you know, whined really pretty, but I didn't get out of it that time. And they took me to the police station, handcuffed me to the wall. You know, I didn't know when they asked if I was right or left-handed that they wanted to cuff one hand to the wall because, you know, we can be pretty rowdy, and left the other free for signing anything they wanted me to sign. That night, I never made it home. I didn't want to call anybody. You know, that's that loneliness that only another alcoholic can know. Well, I ended up not going home, but went to my first meeting the next afternoon, and at that meeting, they, you know, they asked that question, is anybody here for their first AA meeting? And I stood up and I told the whole story the night before. Now, I didn't know that was what you didn't do, because I was new to AA. But everybody smiled and they nodded, and y'all looked happier than I felt at that moment. I was still hungover. I was still in the clothes I had gone to the work before, to work the night before. And I never did any of that stuff. I was a waitress. You had to look good to make good tips, you know, so I could drink as I wanted to afterwards. And at that meeting, I don't remember everything I heard, but I know that people were incredibly kind. And I did hear that to not drink, go to meetings and get a sponsor. Somebody also gave me my big book anonymously, and I still to this day don't know who gave it to me, but it's well used. A week later, I got a sponsor, and I did what she told me to. I didn't know this stuff was optional. You know, you hear, see people pick and choosing, and I think, you know, you do what I did, you'll get what I got, you know, and that's this many years of continuous sobriety, and I've been able to go through a lot of things with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and not drink. My daughter got married, and I put on her wedding exactly the way she wanted. She was the one who suffered the worst from my alcoholism. About a month after that, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and you know, first person I told was my sponsor. She scooped me up. We went to a meeting, and I was never alone through any of that. And then a week after my all clear from the cancer, I was my husband asked for a divorce. I was devastated. I didn't tell anybody. You know, and the big book says we AAs have happy homes. Well, not me. And nothing I went through did I go through alone. And then, as Ron was saying, a little bit after a year of that, being like a newcomer, you know, not drinking, going to meetings, and no relationships for the first year, I met a partner in AA, and how joyous that is to be able to share that. And that really qualifies me. We do want to mention this. We're both service workers. Terry asked us to come and do this. I guess he's done the traditions talk in the past, and he thought we might like to. Well, we do service. My sponsor was a GSR, so I followed her. I was an alternate. And we worked right down the food chain. You know, I was an alternate and a GSR for my home group. I've served at the district level as a district secretary and a DCM. I've worked at the area level. I've held several different positions there. I was the area treasurer, chair, alternate delegate, and most recently I just rotated out of being the delegate for Area 70. It was an incredible privilege to be allowed to do that job for AA as a whole. Now I rotated out, and they still had another job for me, so now I'm the convention chair for Area 70. And how much fun. We had a little intimate convention. Not many more people than are registered for this weekend, a little bit over 100 people. Our hotel got closed by the Vermont Department of Health, so we had to move. But we had a great weekend. It was wonderful. And we had a speaker from GSO. And, you know, it's exactly where I'm supposed to be, celebrating sobriety. And, you know, Ron called and asked, and I said, oh, gosh, you know, it's a summer weekend. I want to do something nice. But I was taught never to say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. So here I am, and, you know, I'd like, before I talk too long, it's Chaz's turn.
Hi, I'm Chaz. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chaz.
Welcome to Vermont. Not exactly Coney Island Avenue and Avenue O, huh? I was born in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And, you know, I had problems growing up. You hear that so many times. I've had the, you know, felt less than. You know, and I started drinking when I was 12. Drank weekends in high school. And I went to school, college in the Bronx. So I was an everyday sit-down at the bar drinker from the time I was 18 to the time I was 42 years old. I knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism, knew very little about myself, actually, didn't understand this concept of the progression of the disease. It just kept on bringing me down, 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 down. You know, my sobriety date is September 11th, 1988, and you know, I didn't want to stop drinking. I just wanted to stop the pain. I had thoughts of suicide. I was desolate, isolated, and hopeless, and I didn't know where to turn. I turned to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found everything I've needed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, in what you've taught me, and in the love of a higher power. I haven't had to drink since then, and I owe it to you and to a loving God. And I'm just like Becky, you know, have been involved in service, did all the jobs, you know, going down the line. My current position is Area 70, Vermont Corrections Chair. I've been going into jails for about 14 or 15 years. You know, people say to me, why did you move up to Vermont? You know, was it the environment? Was it, you know, the beautiful green? I go, I'm a redhead. You know, really cut and dry. The first thing I did when I got up here is I found a home group, and I found a commitment going into a jail. You know, it could have been a treatment facility. It could have been anything. But I had to do something. So I like working in the pits. I really, really do. And that keeps me sober, besides you and AA. Okay, that's it. That's it for qualifications. Becky? Oh, by the way, this is not easy. You know, we've given many, individually, we've given presentations, like Becky said, but, you know, going this back and forth, and then Ron made it very clear, we don't want you to espouse about the traditions. You know, we have a book that tells us all that. You don't have to go through the checklist, the Grapevine Traditions checklist. But we don't want you to do any of that. But just talk for 45 minutes. Becky?
Thanks, Chad. I don't know about you folks, but, you know, it seems to be a trend in meetings lately that at the end of the meeting, people say or chant the responsibility declaration. You know, and we've begun to wonder whether it's just a chant or do we really believe it. How many times have you been in a meeting when they're asking for somebody to open the meeting or to, you know, make coffee, to greet at the door, to do any of the myriad jobs that we have, and nobody answers the call? At a lot of our meetings around here, we ask for people willing to be sponsors to either stand and identify themselves or to raise their hands. And I've been at meetings where, you know, we've been the only people raising our hands. So we've gotten a little maybe jaded about whether people really buy into the responsibility declaration. You know, do we chant it or do we really believe it? And really, to me, the traditions lead us to be responsible, to be true to our message of recovery. You know, and what we're going to really focus on is what do we do to carry the message that the alcoholic still suffers? And we believe that the traditions preserve the fellowship by making sure the groups carry and stay true to our message of recovery. And Chaz is going to talk about when he first got in. And your turn, honey.
Yep. You know, I first walked in and I sat down in the front row because that's where my sponsor told me to sit. First seat in the front. And I'd look up at the walls and I'd see the steps, you know, the window shades with the steps. And I heard them spoken about a lot. But on the other side, I saw these traditions. And I had no idea what it was. I really didn't. And every once in a while, I would ask, and I was told, you know, in the very beginning, that's okay. Let's just talk about not drinking. And, you know, little by little, I saw things. As I started to, you know, become a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous and start participating in a group, and I saw the dynamics of how groups operated and where I fit into this and what my responsibility was to a home group and to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it started to become clear that those 12 points on the chart, you know, started to become important to me. My home group was a group that had been around, I think it started in 73, and that home group ended in 1998. December 19th, 1998 was our last commitment. It was a big speaker meeting. When I first went there, we used to have 150, 200, 250 people at the meeting. We used to put out 5 pots of 100 cuppers, you know, for the one meeting. And it was healthy, it was vibrant, but over the years, and I was there. So by being there, I was a part of. And the group eventually went away. And there were a myriad of reasons why it went away, all of which center around personalities, failure to adhere to the traditions, just lots of things that were going on in the group that people were not capable of rectifying, you know, from within. At the time, I believe I had been a DCM, you know, so I had been working in service work, and I didn't speak up. Or at least I didn't share completely, you know, what had been taught to me. And in retrospect, I could have done so much more, you know, only as a member of the group. And it's always bothered me. And I've always made a pledge that I would try to always do that, you know, we hear that phrase, the next right thing. And so many times it's difficult, you know, When do you talk and how do you talk? You know, we have that phrase, is it kind? Is it necessary? What's the third one?
Is it true?
And is it true? You know, and those three criteria to address a problem, you know, can we do it kindly? Is it true and is it necessary? And sometimes it's a difficult decision. But I've made up my mind that a lack of courage in doing the right thing wasn't going to stop me from adhering to the traditions and sharing what I've learned.
Thanks, Chaz. We were both sort of looking for, you know, a hook, something that would get us excited about this little talk. And yesterday I was talking with another woman, alcoholic, on the phone. She's relatively new in sobriety. And was really upset. Now, I'm sure nobody else can relate to that in early sobriety. But there's a myriad of problems. And she's one of those alcoholics who has problems other than alcohol. And that's you know, it's always tough as somebody who's been around to talk about, share our experience, strength, and hope. We talked for about 45 minutes, and there were professional issues, there was family issues going on, you know, sponsorship issues. And, you know, when I got off the phone with her, I realized that there were some things that went on in that conversation that really talked, that were very clear that when I was following what the traditions say to us, I was giving her the best guidance and the same that was given to me. And one of them was is that... The doctor and medication issue, and we have a great pamphlet on that. but that I really have no experience. I'm not a doctor. I have no opinion on outside issues. And when she was talking about those types of things, I needed to encourage her to talk to her professionals, that I don't have experience with that, that, you know, I never have any business in telling anybody that they shouldn't be on medications. And, you know, she's talking about going off of them. And, oh, my God, the ramifications of that. You know, people can get seriously ill or die from that. So I'm like, you've got to talk to your doctor about that. You cannot just make a decision and stop doing that. So to refer back to it, you know, really, you know, speaks very clearly of the traditions to me. And I was thinking also about our primary purpose. Again, you know, I don't really have any to talk, share about outside problems. But all I can share with her is my experience, strength, and hope, and staying sober, and how I did that. Because, boy, I had troubles outside of my alcoholism. I had relationship issues and job issues. But, you know, my sponsor always kept it really clear to me. And when I focus on those things that the traditions talk to us about, I am a better sponsor. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to share some experiences, just like we just did, that we've had that have led us to believe how important the traditions are. They're not meant to be used as weapons to bludgeon other people into submission to our will. Believe me, I've tried that. But rather to keep us true to our message of recovery. And, you know, maybe, Chaz, do you want to talk about?
Sure. I had a friend and a sponsee, and I'm not going to use his name. I have a habit of using people's names, even though you don't know them. But it doesn't matter. This fellow had problems. He had some emotional problems, and he was taking medications for them also. But in dealings with Tradition 1, you know, Common Welfare, and Tradition 2, the group conscience, and 3, you know, the only requirement. This fellow was a member of AA, and he belonged in AA, but he bordered on violent, on being violent. And on more than one occasion, there were altercations. He was prone to fits of anger. And you can see where I'm going in regards to groups started banning him from meetings. And at the time, I was area chair. And this was, you know, the type of thing that I would be called on, you know, to address by numerous groups would have a problem. And they'd turn to the general service workers in a specific area for shared experience, not an opinion, but shared experience. And I found that I was called on to act almost like a mediator. And that's a kind of uncomfortable position, but I was able to call upon the traditions and the group experience, you know, in general. Also called up GSO to get, you know, to get feedback on that. You know, we have a fourth tradition that says that each group is autonomous, that they can make their own decisions. But I was also told that every group has the right to be wrong. You have the right to be wrong. So a decision can be wrong, and no one's going to give you a hard time, but you're going to have to answer. We have to answer to that sooner or later. You know, so what a wonderful experience that it ultimately worked out, you know, through patience and kindness and talking to groups and letting them know that this gentleman was, you know, had special problems and might have to be treated a little differently with a little more love and a little more tolerance. That person celebrated 9 years recently. So, you know, These are working tools to not only to keep your group healthy and sober, but for individuals to maintain their sobriety under trying circumstances.
I have a similar experience I'd like to share. There was a gal who was coming to our group, and at that time there were 3 groups that were meeting in our same building, and she was a wild one. You know, she'd like go to one meeting and she'd stuff money from the collection basket into her pants, you know, and nobody knew what to do, you know. She was very active, but she kept coming back to meetings. There was something here that she really wanted. I really liked her. I could relate to her a lot, you know. There was some gals who were scared, you know, and we're pretty scary when we're active, and they weren't really sure what to do, and they went to the church elders and where we meet, and they said that, you know, they're really scared of this person. And what ended up happening was the church took out a restraining order so that she couldn't come in within a certain amount of room around our church, which meant that it didn't only affect that one meeting, but it meant that she couldn't come to either any of our group's three meetings or the other group's meetings. And, you know, we were just absolutely appalled. You know, and that really speaks to me about, you know, we're autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. And I just don't believe that we do that. You know, we don't go and take legal action against, you know, another alcoholic. Now, it was really the church that took the action. And it was very interesting because, you know, GSO got pulled into that, and we were reminded that, you know, each group has a right to be wrong, and what are you going to do? And, you know, I would drive by her house, and I would see her out in the lawn, and I'd stop and talk and be friendly and say, you know, we really want you to come back, but we can't disobey the law, you know, but, you know, you're welcome when this gets lifted. And the church ended up, we went and talked to the other group, and we talked to the church, and, you know, it's funny how, you know, when you're trying to live by the traditions, sometimes you go overboard. You're a little harsher than you want to be, and that happened in part of this process, and sometimes you're not as rigidly adhering to the traditions as might be desired. But all three groups ended up working together and working with the church, and eventually the restraining order was lifted. But it was such an uncomfortable period of time. And, you know, when we expanded our group to have more than one meeting, we looked at when groups were meeting around us so that we weren't in direct competition. You know, we're a small area and there's not a lot of bodies to go around. So it's really a concern that if you set up a meeting on the same night as one in the immediate next town, you may draw people from that and cause that group to go away. Well, this incident with the restraining order really had the same effect. It affected other groups. So, you know, that was something that really affected me. Now, the other little story really quick I'd like to share is I sponsored a young gal, happened to be Jewish, and our group's a little bit hardcore, you know. We've been called Big Book Thumpers. Now, there's another name that's often used, and you've probably heard it, you know, the AA Nazis. She came from another group, and she'd heard somebody calling us AA Nazis. She was, I mean, when I even talk about it now, I find it is such an offensive term. And, you know, do we talk badly about other groups? Now, to me, that's like the worst thing you can say about another group. And I know that when people are in trouble, they often come to our group, and if they think we're a little hardcore sometimes, she was devastated. And to think that we could do that to each other, you know, just, you know, really speaks to tradition one to me.
Okay, we're going to hop around a little bit. You know, the other night we were at a corrections volunteer dinner. And, you know, we go into a Marble Valley correctional facility in Rutland. So once a year they put on a dinner for the people that, you know, Bible study, AA, NA, and whatnot. And afterwards, the volunteer coordinator came up to Becky. I was chatting with someone else and said, you know, we wanted to give you guys an award, but, you know, Becky told me that and said, well, that was the right thing. I said, I don't know. I wanted the award. I wanted one. But, you know, how do you handle something like that? So we have an 11th tradition that tells us that, you know, we are not the voice of AA. We're not the, you know, we're not the picture of AA. So we just kind of sat there and we enjoyed knowing that our reward, you know, or award or certificate or what, or plaque, was the fact that we were doing what we had to do to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and stay sober ourselves. Why don't you talk about the international?
We got to go to the international in Toronto in
2005. It was our honeymoon.
It's nice they had a big party for us. But we got there. We were there a little early. We like to go early to places and, you know, leave late. And a friend of ours who's a past delegate from Northern Jersey suggested that we go to where GSO had set up their PI, public information area, because they might need some help escorting some of the press around to see what it was like. Well, it turned out what ended up happening was is they decided they wanted to interview us. Oh, my gosh. And I got interviewed for a spot on the news on TV, and Chaz got interviewed for a newspaper article. Well, it was really interesting because to see how the press really respects our anonymity tradition. They had me do pour a million cups of coffee, so they saw my hands, and then the fellow interviewed me, and all I did was do it from the neck down, and they showed my name badge, which is pretty anonymous, Becky, and where I'm from. But it was in Toronto, so nobody down here was watching that particular, the news in Toronto. And the really funny part is, and thank God we do it anonymously, because the interviewer goes, well, how much did you used to drink? And I go, 3. Now, 3 used to always be the number I'd say to my husband at the time when I got home. He'd go, well, how much did you drink? That was a lie. It was amazing how fast that comes back. And I laughed, and I couldn't really explain it. But it really wasn't what we drank, but the effect. And I tried to talk to that. But the way they guarded our anonymity, and we watched it on TV. And if I didn't know it was me, I wouldn't have known it was me. It was just so cool. Chaz.
Yeah, we're talking about Tradition 3, the only requirement for membership. And just a little comparison. The way our home group handles it now, the Fairhaven group in Fairhaven, Vermont, and a group that I was not a member of, but I was a regular participant of. I used to go to this group. When someone would walk in to this closed meeting that wasn't an alcoholic, they had a set way of handling it. And first of all, if you have a greeter, you don't have to worry a bit. It's not a problem because a greeter gets to know everyone who comes to the meeting. And I don't know about you, when I walked in, I wore a sweatshirt that said newcomer. But what we would do is if someone came in and the greeter would literally, hey, how are you? My name's Chaz. Are you an alcoholic? If the person said no, we immediately talk to them briefly, get a cup of coffee, go out in the hallway, and let them know that this was a closed meeting. And just like in Brooklyn, where you guys are from, there are plenty of meetings. And one of us would get in the car and drive. This was a 7:30 meeting. We drive to an 8 o'clock meeting down the street that was an open meeting. And it was handled very kindly and diplomatically, but also giving people, trying to give them an understanding of what open and closed meetings were, and just as importantly, preserving the anonymity of people that were expecting to be at a closed meeting.
Now, the Fairhaven group handles that a little bit differently. Our Monday night, where we study the steps out of the 12 and 12, is a closed meeting. And, at the beginning of the meeting, we go around and introduce ourselves. Well, you're already into the meeting. And in our group conscience, we've really struggled with this, is what do you do? Somebody identifies as, oh, I'm here just to check it out, or I got sent by the court, or, I'm an addict. What do you do? And we, through a lot of struggles, what the group conscience has decided is rather than ask somebody to leave after the meeting's started, now that's really harsh, and who are we to determine if somebody's an alcoholic or not? What we do is after the meeting, a woman will go up to the woman or a man to the man and we'll ask questions, are you an alcoholic? Do you have a desire to stop drinking? And we'll gently explain the difference between an open and a closed meeting. You know what happens when a mother comes in and she brings her kids to a closed meeting? We usually will offer to take the kids off and play with them. We've got a little landing in the entry, or go outside and walk if it's a nice day. But, for a group that's often judged as harsh, we found that this works really well for us. In fact, we've got a fellow coming now, and, we don't know if anybody's talked to him, so it's time to have that little talk. Are you in the right place? Experience has shown, if you call GSO, they'll talk about this, that, we're great for alcoholics, but we could kill somebody else who comes to the rooms and they're not one of us. And I don't want to be responsible for that. We need, we do one thing really well. You know, it talks about that in the essays in the 12 and 12.
Okay, now we'll talk about both 4 and 6. You know, each group is autonomous, and 6, you know, A, does not endorse, finance, or lend the name to 15 minutes. We thought that we weren't going to have enough time. You know, we didn't have enough content to talk, but you put two alcoholics next to a microphone. Why don't you talk about New Orleans?
In relatively early sobriety, I was on a business trip, and I was in New Orleans of all places, you know. And, you know, what did I do? I started every day with a meeting, and there were great meetings down there. Well, one morning, I'm not a morning person, so I was actually amazed that I caught this. The group, they did a treasurer's report, and they had passed the basket beforehand, and then the treasurer starts reading off, and they go, and we donated X amount of dollars to the fill-in-the-blank homeless shelter. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, I thought my money was going to help another alcoholic. Now, I don't have anything against homeless shelters. In fact, I'm all for them. But my money in the basket is meant to help another alcoholic, and that's where I expect for it to go. Now, herein lies the rub. What do you do? I'm a visitor. But I believe that I'm responsible wherever I go to, and if I don't stand up for the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been taught by you folks, then shame on me. You know, am I going to walk out and tell that story and not say anything? So I raised my hand, and I said, I'm confused. I'm not exactly sure what I said, but I basically shared my confusion that I thought the money in the basket was going to help another alcoholic, that I understand that maybe your group conscience, but it's not my understanding. And that was it. I can accept what a group's decision is. I've learned that the hard way. But after the meeting, some people came up and said, I'm so glad you spoke up. I've wanted to, and I was afraid to. Now, maybe God put me there at that moment, but I'm really grateful that I've learned that in the program.
There was an instance where I was a DCM back in the early 90s, and someone came to me and said, a local group is just sitting on a bunch of money that they don't know what to do, and they're talking about putting in a new kitchen for the church. And I said, well, you know, that takes a lot of money. And they said, yeah, $10,000 or $15,000. And that's what they were sitting on. And I said, well, it's, you know, I can't do anything unless I'm invited. And a couple of the group members asked me to come to a business meeting. When I went to the business meeting, I reiterated, I'm not going to talk unless you all agree, you know, to have me address this. And, you know, we just sat down and we talked about it. You know, where does the money in the basket go to? You know, yes, you can do it. Again, you're a group. You can make that decision if you want. But, you know, you're lying, you know, the dollars in the basket. Terry, and this is in the Senior Handbook, and I had to, I used to do a lot of writing for our Area 44 newsletter This Day. And in your handbook, one of your past, and I'm using the word yours from New York, one of your past delegates, there's a phrase there that says that the money in the basket, AA groups are merely the custodians of the money in the basket. That money is earmarked for Alcoholics Anonymous and no other purpose. And it's the obligation of the groups to make sure that that's their fiduciary responsibility, you know, and it just became very clear what to do. I tried to give that information to the group, and they decided not to, you know, to make that donation. I think they had like a 6-month picnic with $15,000, you know, but that's their choice. But it didn't go to the church.
I would like to throw out some tidbits about the seventh tradition. One of the things that when you do service work, you get to do presentations, and the treasurer of the General Service Board told us that it takes 9 single space pages to report all the services that are performed at the General Service Office for us groups and for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. Now, that's a big bang for the buck. If you guys, money in the basket goes towards, you know, you send it on to district, central office, the area and general service, your money goes really far. you know, what happens when the baskets pass? What happens to the money in the basket? In our home group, we send contributions to the district, to the area, and GSO, just like rent. We don't do it as the extra money. We just have a set amount every other month that we send off. And, you know, we know that we're spiritually connected to AA as a whole. I found my first meeting by calling the AA hotline that's funded by our district. When I first heard that the big book was translated into Swahili, I was excited to be part of this. I don't know anybody who speaks Swahili, but isn't that cool? My dollar in the basket gets carried around the world. Some of our folks from GSO just went to the first meeting in Tibet, you know, and they were in yurts on a hillside. Isn't that exciting? If you send your money on, you're part of that. I could go on. I'm a past area treasurer, so you know, I think I've given you a little bit of tidbits about how important the money in the basket is.
You know, a lot of this is, you know, fine line stuff, and I'll give you a perfect example, you know, about endorsing and using the name of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you like that? Isn't that great? Well, you know, I'm a graphic artist. I have a marketing company, and, you know, I printed up six of these just as a prototype, and I said, you know, these are really cool. You know, circus cover, big books, you know, T-shirts. You know, $10 for short sleeve, you know, $14 for long sleeve. And I kept on looking at them and looking at them and looking at them. And there, all six of them are on a shelf in my closet, you know. And I just can't do it. I just can't take something from Alcoholics Anonymous, something so precious, something that's trademarked, you know, and use it to personally make money. Very possibly, if I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could do it. But, you know, to come here and say that I study this and I live it and I'm grateful, you know, to be for everything that was given me, and then to on the other hand, use it and compromise it is really difficult. You know, so these are the little decisions. These are the things that you have taught us.
Yeah. Now, we're going to throw out just a few more tidbits because we have 5 minutes left. Have you ever sat in a meeting and heard somebody go, "My name's so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic and a recovering Catholic"? I have, you know, now.
How about Bronx Irish Catholic? Huh?
Left-handed Catholic. You know, I sit there and all of a sudden I realize how uncomfortable I am with that. You know, there may be a newcomer who comes to the room, or even some of us old-timers who sit there and go, "Gee, I'm a Catholic, and this person is dissing my religion, something that I believe in deeply." You know, what is that message carrying? How tolerant are we are of other people's beliefs? Remember, it says we have no opinion on outside issues. You know, we're talking about, you know, talking to the outside world. But I believe what we do in the meetings is just as important. What message are we carrying?
You know, that with that, you know, tradition 10, we have no opinion. You know, how much, you know, a lot of us work with sponsors and sponsees. I had a sponsee that taught me a lesson. You know, it was before a meeting that we were talking politics. And I made the comment, well, you know, and he made it very clear to me that it was his understanding that, you know, the politics don't belong before the meeting, especially during the meeting, and then after the meeting too. Because how easy it is to turn people off and start engaging in controversy. We do not involve ourselves in controversy. That was just a lesson that a sponsee taught me.
I love that Alcoholics Anonymous is an oasis to me. Now, you know, most of you can really relate to this. You know, when 9/11 happened, I worked for a federal agency, and we watched it as it was happening on the TV, you know, on the TV at work. And you know, Oklahoma City really hit home hard, but I remember after 9/11 going to my home group, and we would just talk about alcoholism and recovery from it. Maybe people were emotional, and we've learned to talk in a general way about our problems in the outside world, but I didn't have to go to a meeting and deal with the horrific things that were happening in the outside world. And I needed that. I needed to remember that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety no matter what was going on in the outside world. And then when I heard that we had a meeting, you know, at Ground Zero for the workers, that just touched me so much to know that people like us were being taken care of even at their greatest time of need.
You know, one other thing, you know, we keep on going back to the fact that we're service workers because we really believe that service workers have really kept us entrenched in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Tradition 9 talks about, you know, AA should not be organized or as least organized as possible, but we may employ special workers. I mean, when Bonnie talked about, you know, this institution, which is not Alcoholics Anonymous, but has that same thing. They need special workers, you know, and we talk about general service per se, and we hear people use the term, it's politics. Well, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to a delegate in Florida that was saying that she was being criticized for being involved with AA politics. And the brunt of his message was, of course there's politics in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's good politics and there's bad politics. Good politics lends itself to statesmanship. Bad politics lends itself to greed and self-serving and eventually drinking. So it's up to us to choose whether we want to get involved in the politics of Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly ascribe to the politics of Alcoholics Anonymous, but on the side of statesmanship and doing the next right thing.
One of the wonderful things in being a service worker, when I was at the General Service Conference in New York, we got to hear some tapes, clips from Bill's talks. And one of the ones that he talked about the story that you read in the traditions about that early AA who had problems other than alcohol. And it was so phenomenal. Now, we've talked about, is it kind, is it necessary, and is it true? Now, a past General Service trustee talked about this talk and thinking about how Bill would look at what we're doing in AA, and what Bob Peace said at the General Service Conference in 1986 was, he decried AA's growing rigidity. He said, and in this trend towards rigidity, we are drifting farther and farther away from our co-founders. Bill in particular must be spinning in his grave, for he was perhaps the most permissive person I ever met. And ever since I heard that talk, Bill's talk, and then that little quote, I've really had to ask myself, as I believe in the traditions with all my heart and soul, and what do I do with them? Do I use them as a hammer, or do I use them to guide me? Chaz?
I think that's it. We want to thank you for the opportunity to come and share with you what we've learned, but what you've taught us.
Both to Terry and to Ron, thank you.
Drunks. This young lady is Liz. And Liz S. started coming to the Atlanta Group, I believe, around 6 years ago. And Liz, at the time, lived around the corner from where I lived. And a lot of times after the Tuesday or sometimes after the Thursday beginners meeting we have, we would walk home together and we would talk. And I believe Liz had about 5 years at the time. 5 and a half years, excuse me. Don't take my time from me. That was the toughest 6 months I had in my sobriety. You're not taking it from me. And we would talk, you know, about the Atlanta Group, about sobriety, about the AA. And then she moved down to the Lower East Side from the Upper East Side. And she continued to come to Atlanta Group. But I missed those walks and those talks we had. You know, you people sober up, you get to be the most sentimental people in the world. And so I'm glad that she was able to come and do this big book study today. And the gentleman on her left is a guy I call English Roger, because he was born in England. And he lives on the west side. I live on the east side of Manhattan. If you know anything about AA meetings in Manhattan, you know if you live on the east side, you don't go to meetings on the west side. And if you live on the west side, you don't cross Fifth Avenue to go to meetings on the east side. You know? But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I used to see him around a lot. A lot, you know? And we've always stayed in contact over the years, you know? And I figured, well, let me try and get a guy from the west side. Let's see what he knows about the big book, you know? So I'm very happy and proud that he was able to come this weekend and do this as well. And with that, I give you Liz and Roger.
Hi, everybody. I'm Liz, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi. Hi, my name is Roger Taylor. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.
Such an honor to be here. Thanks, Ron, for that awesome introduction. I actually moved to the Upper West Side, and I do travel still to the East Side for my meetings, just to be complete honest. I wanted to thank Bonnie for that wonderful history of the house and for our speakers on the traditions. What a great way to kick off the morning. Good morning. Just want to talk a little bit about myself just to qualify that I'm here. I am a proud member of the Atlanta Group. My anniversary is January 28th, 1997. They were the hardest 6 months of my entire sobriety. I'm going to make sure I get them. And I'm currently working on step 9 and practicing 10, 11, and 12. I got sober when I was in college. I was living in Boston at the time, and I was a total whiskey hound. I just drank to excess from the minute I started drinking, and I never had any control once I put it into my body how much I was going to take. My life was completely miserable, and when I came into AA, I used to think that alcohol was only my problem, and then I found out after many years of being dry as a desert that actually I was the problem. And then I found this home group and a solution. And I'm so excited to dive into the book today because this is where I have found the life beyond my wildest dreams. It wasn't anywhere else. It was just in these first 164, which brought me to a higher power, which I hope that we can all get to know a little bit better this weekend.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Roger Taylor. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Roger.
Can everyone hear me in the back? Good. In the words of Wavy Gravy, at Woodstock in 1969. Good morning, y'all. We have breakfast for X number of people. My sober date is June 17th, 1994, which meant that this past Tuesday I celebrated 14 years of sobriety.
Woohoo!
I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous I stopped drinking on June 17th and came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous the following August 2nd, when I went to my first meeting. I didn't believe I had a problem, and I certainly didn't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous had any kind of a solution for me, and I went to that meeting determined that it was not going to work for me. As I left that first meeting, a gentleman said to me, you know, there's another meeting here tomorrow. Why don't you meet me? And every fiber of my being wanted to say no. I just wanted to not look at him, not talk to him, walk away and forget this whole thing. But I now believe, and it's only in hindsight, I now believe that a small voice spoke to me and I said yes. And that would have been August 3rd, 1994. And I've been coming to meetings ever since. My home group is the Oxford Groups on the Upper West Side. I also have a men's meeting home group out in Quogue, which is out in the east end of Long Island, which at this moment has just wrapped up their Saturday morning meeting. It's a privilege to be here. I was really thrilled when Ron asked me. And one of the things that my very first sponsor, after second or third meeting with him, invited me to go back to his office after the meeting, presented me with a small pocket-sized copy of the big book, and said, are you ready to do the work? And obviously everyone here probably knows what my initial thought was. And again, because of that small voice inside of me, I said yes. And it has been a pleasure and a privilege for me to work with him, with other people who have believed that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in this book. Not necessarily at the meetings, not necessarily at the meeting before and after, all of which are very important. But to me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in this book. And I'm really looking forward to being co-presenter here with Liz this weekend. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, so let's get started into the book. We're going to start off here with the preface. And I did a little research after I was asked to speak here to find out what's the difference between a preface and a foreword, because I had no idea. And what I found out is the preface is generally written by the author of the book to tell us it's a preliminary statement setting forth its purpose and scope. That's what the preface is. And the foreword is customarily written by someone else other than the author. But since we know that the first 100 men and women technically wrote this book, it's hard to say who was the author. God obviously was the author. But the foreword was not written, is customarily not written by the person who wrote the book. But to start with a preface, which, you know, what's the preliminary statement setting forth the purpose and scope is, you know, it tells us in the second paragraph that this is the basic text of our society. And when I think about a textbook and what I tell women when I sponsor them is, you know, a textbook is meant to be studied. It's meant to be studied and to start from the beginning and go straight through. Now, if you were to take a math class, you're not about to start with like astrophysics. You need to learn how to do addition first. So you start with addition, then you go to subtraction, then multiplication, and then you work your way down, and then you could go to astrophysics. You're not going to just jump right into the middle. So it's a textbook. It's meant to start from the beginning and to work your way through. And so it's the blueprint. It's where we, you know, we get our design for a living. That's what I have found. And it's a textbook is also a tool used to transfer information. And what I know that means for me is that whenever I'm working with other women or I'm speaking anywhere or I am doing any kind of service, whether it's in the rooms or out of the rooms, I'm always drawn to the book. It's always centered in the book. This is where everything comes from. Everything else for me is just my opinion. It's just and my experience, which is important, but sometimes my experience can get a little skewed by my opinion. So I try to keep it in the book. And it says here, and that same paragraph, the first portion of this volume is describing the AA recovery program. So that's the purpose. It's to describe the AA recovery program, and recovery is to be restored to a state of normalcy, which is hopefully when we come into these rooms, what's going to happen if we do this work, if we do the work out of this textbook. And then, of course, the last paragraph in the preface, which is, you know, really important. It teaches me how to identify. It tells me that, you know, of course, the preface, it tells us about other things that are happening in the book, like, you know, the personal stories, how they've changed, we've added, we've subtracted. And I always like to say, why do we read this is, you know, why am I going to cut corners in the very beginning of my program? You know, it'd be so easy just to jump right in on page one. But why am I going to cut corners and like miss out on the preface and to see how transparent AA is and how transparent our fellowship is? And it's not one of these things where we're going to you know, wonder in the back of my head, who's running this show? What's really going on? What are they hiding from me? It's all right here. It's in the preface and the forewords. And then, like I said, the last paragraph where we talk about identification, you know, the yes, that happened to me. Yes, I felt like that. Yes, I believe this program can work for me too, which is, of course, where we all hope when we carry the message. Is what's going to happen if we're properly armed with facts about ourselves is to help people find that. So, do you want to share anything about the preface?
No,
you good?
I'm good.
All right. So that's my little talk about the preface, to talk about the scope and purpose of the book. And then we go right into the forewords, and there are four forewords because there are four editions. I currently work out of the third edition, although I'm familiar with the fourth edition's forward as well. You know, I think we should spend most of the time on the doctor's opinion, but just to talk about the forewords a little bit. You know, the first foreword, the first word is we. It's a, you know, we program. This book was authored by the first 100 men and women. And it just basically tells us who's behind the book. What is this about? The first paragraph also tells us that, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And, you know, there's a lot of debate back and forth. Do we recover? Are we cured? I mean, my humble opinion, obviously, I'm never cured from this disease. It's something that I have a daily reprieve of. But like I was told that, you know, we can recover return to a state of normalcy, but in a hair of a second, I can unrecover and be returned to a state of insanity, as I am multiple times throughout the day. And then I have an opportunity to be recovered again by my loving, tolerant sponsor. And it says here that this book is telling us precisely, it's a very important word, precisely how we have recovered, and how we've done this. And that's the main purpose of this book. And it, you know, the bottom of this paragraph, it tells us that many do not comprehend the alcoholic as a very sick person. And I honestly believe that probably the alcoholic is the last person to realize how sick of a person that we really are. You know, our neighbors, our family, our employers, our spouses, our children, they probably will realize that we're sick way before that we are. We're the last ones to generally realize that, you know, we're a sick bunch. We're not bad. We're not evil. We're sick. We have a disease. We have, you know, and so we're the last ones to see it. And so this book will also help, you know, help us comprehend the nature of our illness and, of course, how to recover from that. And to go on a little bit farther into the forward of the first edition, requirement is an honest desire to stop drinking, which is in our preamble. And, of course, we simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. You know, that's all I'm here to do, is I just want to be helpful to those who are afflicted from alcoholism. That's my main purpose. That's my primary purpose today. And skipping ahead to the foreword of the second edition, which is really the meat and potatoes of the history. So I'm going to put a little plug in. We were talking earlier, is that the last session that we're going to get to talk about, that Roger and I actually get a chance to talk about, is A Vision for You. Which is, I think, the Hamlet of the big book. It is so beautiful. It's perfect. It is. So if you're thinking of skipping out and heading over to the outlets, I really urge you to at least do them on the way back to New York or Maine or wherever you're going to, because Vision for You really sets forth the history and, you know, those few moments before when Bill met Bob in the Mayflower Hotel in such masterly detail. I mean, I just get moved every time I read it. So if you – I highly urge you to stick around for that, because you have a whole hour just for that chapter. But forward to the second edition is that, you know, one of my favorite parts is this part on, it's the second page, bless you, of the forward to second edition, where it says that though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups talking about Bill, he was convinced of the needs of moral inventory, confessions of personality defects. And I was thinking to myself, I'm like, what an alcoholic. Like, they gave him the tenets and he's like, well, maybe I can fix them a little bit. How can I make them work? It's like he just didn't readily accept them. He like sort of tinkered with them a little bit to come up with our 12 steps, which, you know, obviously that's what works and that's what has helped me recover and hopefully all of you to recover. But this idea that, you know, Bill was just one of us, you know, just a drunk, and that he wasn't all like, yeah, let's just jump right on the bandwagon. But him, too, rebellion dogged his every step. You know, and I think straight from the beginning, they talk about this necessity to carry this message to another alcoholic, where he talks about suddenly he realized in order to save himself, again, talking about Bill and the Mayflower Hotel, which will get into in The Vision for You, he must carry this message to another alcoholic. And, you know, I just get so touched, especially when Bonnie was talking about the history, like, you know, it's just one alcoholic talking to another. Like, you know, I very often can put Bill and Bob on a pedestal and make them about, like, as, you know, unearthly as, like, Shakespeare or something. And I forget that they're just humans. And they're just like what miracle to have that happen, that moment that though these two men should come together and to create this society and this fellowship that saved my life. Like, I could be dead. And I don't know about you guys, but like, my life was hanging on by a thread, and those two guys in that hotel, that moment, like, is why I'm alive today. You know, and it says here, you know, forward to second edition, is that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. Vital means necessary for life. How do I stay sober? How do I want permanent recovery? It's strenuous work. Strenuous. Not, you know, just showing up whenever I want to. Sometimes strenuous work can be inconvenient. It could be at odd times of the night. It means I have to go to meetings and do step work with sponsees, even though I don't want to. It means when it's raining, I still have to go to meetings. When it's snowing, I still have to go to meetings. I still have to answer the phone, even though my favorite TV show is on. I have to do this work for me to stay sober. You know, hopefully they will too, who's ever on the other line. But for me to stay sober, I have to have, you know, this is what I have to do. And so, again, it goes on about some more of the history. And just a couple of things that I want to talk about is this idea of John D. Rockefeller, that dinner party is that's basically where a seventh tradition where we talked about for, you know, the collections was helped created by this John D. Rockefeller, because he's the one who told Bill and Bob that money's going to spoil this thing, meaning AA, money's going to spoil this thing. And I was told a story that the John D. Rockefeller actually gave AA I know I'm not a history buff by any sense of the word, but I was told that John D. Rockefeller actually gave AA $5,000 to help rebuild like Dr. Bob's house and to help us get the book started. But because of the way we are, we actually paid him all back. And John D. Rockefeller, that's like saying, like, you know, Donald Trump gave us like chump change, you know, and for him it meant nothing. But for us to be completely self-supporting, that we did it even then. Thank you. And then, of course, the need for the traditions, which we heard about in wonderfully this morning, is these questions. Could these large number of erstwhile erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together? What? Would there be quarrels over membership, leadership, and money? Probably. Would there be strivings for power and prestige? Most likely. And would there be schisms which would split AA apart? Absolutely. And then the traditions were born out of those questions and the need to make sure that that didn't happen. And it hasn't happened with, you know, for people who live with the traditions in their lives. You know, and then it's just, it's always really important to remember that where we come from, to have the, you know, to remember, like I said, it was just drunks who created this. You know, again, forward to the second edition still, it says that the reason that AA, this is where they talk about like the mushrooming process of AA growing. We had these articles written by Jack Alexander and all these places, and John D. Rockefeller, and we're growing and growing and growing. And they were talking about why are we growing so much. And it says there are two principal reasons that AA was growing at this time in 1935. The first one is a large number of recoveries and the reunited homes. Those were the two, you know, the proof is in the pudding, that they saw that this was actually working. This can work. People are staying sober and homes are being reunited. And that was good enough for the time back then. And then they go into some statistics and they talk about how, in 1955, there was a 75% recovery rate. I think it was 50% got sober and stayed sober, and then 25% went in and out, but eventually stayed sober. And so 75, they said that there was a 75% recovery rate. Now, I'm not like any kind of math whiz. I don't know the rates right now, but it says that for people who really tried, people who really did this work, and those are pretty good odds for someone who's going to really, you know, follow this program, follow this textbook, do it, you know, one page after the other, you know, the way it's outlined. 75% is, I mean, that's fantastic. And you know, the last thing I want to talk about the second edition is that it says that upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. The book here says that only a spiritual experience will conquer our alcoholism. And all I know is for me personally, for Liz, you know, all the yoga, ashrams, meditation on its own, going to